famous artistic survivals. But what did these two most popular Anglo-Saxon associations have in common with each other? They were separated by almost half a millennium, during which there had been an enormous amount of change. Harold was the ruler of a single kingdom, which contemporaries called England, with boundaries very close to where they are today. It was peaceful and prosperous, with an expanding economy, an abundant silver coinage, and dozens of towns, cities, and ports. It was also a Christian country, with 16 cathedrals, around 60 monasteries, and thousands of local churches. At the time of the Sutton Hoo burial, the picture was very different. What would eventually become England was a gaggle of smaller kingdoms, all vying against each other for temporary advantage. None of them had a settlement of more than a few hundred people, or silver coins, or much in the way of trade. Nor was there much organized Christianity, which had arrived only a generation earlier and had so far made very little progress. Almost everyone was still pagan, worshipping gods like Thunor, Free, and Woden. King Harold, who lived in a world of bishops, boroughs, shires, and sheriffs, would probably have felt far more at home with the English of the later Middle Ages than the people who had buried their lord in a boat over four centuries earlier. Those intervening centuries had been ones of fundamental transformation. Generalizations about the Anglo-Saxons are consequently difficult, and unless made at the most simplistic levels, fairly redundant. It is as meaningful to talk about Anglo-Saxon warfare, for instance, as it would be to generalize about military tactics between the 14th and the 19th centuries. In this book, therefore, I have for the most part avoided wide-ranging discussions and tried to chart major social and political developments as they occurred. Each chapter seeks to explore the dominant theme of a particular era. Chapter 3, for example, discusses the second half of the 7th century, which saw the dynamic expansion of Christianity and the foundation of monasteries and bishoprics. Of course, there were other important things happening in Britain during this time, and these are also discussed, but only as secondary concerns. This approach has meant that a lot of material has inevitably ended up on the cutting room floor. But it is impossible to write about a period that spans more than 7 centuries, from Roman Britain to the Norman conquest, without being selective. By confining myself to one major theme per chapter, my hope has been to create a clearer story. In the case of most chapters, I've also concentrated on one particular historical character. 4 are focused on individual kings, 2 on individual bishops, and 1 on an individual family, the Godwinsons. Again, this was primarily in the interests of narrative clarity, and because biography is a way of framing events in relatable human terms. At the same time, I wanted the book to be more than just a series of unrelated portraits, so there is plenty of non-biographical material included in each chapter, exploring the book's wider themes and linking one chapter to the next. This is not intended as a series of potted histories, but as an account of the emergence of the English and the development of England. Sadly, none of the chapters is focused on a woman, because there is simply not enough evidence to sustain such an extended treatment. In the case of certain kings and bishops, we are lucky to have contemporary accounts of their lives, but in the case of queens or abbesses, no such source material has survived. The Venerable Bede provides a few brief sections on particular religious women in his mammoth Ecclesiastical History, written in the early 8th century. After that, there are no narrative sources about women until the mid-11th century, when 2 queens, Emma and Edith, commissioned political tracts that touched on aspects of their careers. Yet even these late sources, valuable as they are, contain insufficient material to support an entire chapter. Frustratingly, there are periods where we can discern that certain women were playing a pivotal political role. On several occasions in the 10th century, young kings come and go in quick succession, while their mothers continue at court from one reign to the next, appearing as the leading witnesses to royal charters. But powerful though these women were, their activities are otherwise unrecorded, and their personalities and careers are unrecoverable. This gap in the evidence might seem surprising, given that the Anglo-Saxon era is often thought of as having been a golden age for women. Since the late 18th century, it has been a commonplace that women in England had better rights before the Norman conquest than they did afterwards, and were held in higher esteem by society. Before 1066, said one eminent historian in the mid-20th century, men and women enjoyed a